Empire Podcast this week, it's another guest jamboree as we welcome the Queen of England herself, Claire Foy, plus the men behind Brawl in Cellblock 99, Vince Vaughn and S. Craig Soller. All that and more on the Movie Podcast. It is now having to wait a week for episodes of The Good Place. It is absolute torture. Hey, wait a minute. Is this The Bad Place? Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the Empire Podcast. This week, I'm joined by two colleagues of such lethal cunning. There is, of course, our geek queen, Helen O'Hara.
Hello.
And our West Wing guru, James Dyer.
Hi.
But just for the third time in the podcast's history, our ranks are being swelled by an outsider. He is the co-creator of Peep Show and Fresh Meat. He is the co-writer of Four Lions. And lately, he's been striking out in the zone with a new TV show, a radio series, and now a bloody play as well. Welcome, Sam Bain. How are you?
Great to be here.
It's good to have you here. So, yes, tell us all about this play.
It's called The Retreat. It opens terrifyingly soon. So as we record, it's meant to open next, previews start next week.
Yes.
And Kathy Burke's directing it.
Amazing. Amazing.
The Park Theatre. Yeah.
Park Theatre, which is literally three doors down from where I used to live in Finsbury Park.
Well, that's why we picked it.
Because you knew I'd moved away.
So I could like, is he gone yet? Is it safe to go in there?
I would often haunt the park. Going, is Sam Bain here yet? With his play, where's Kathy Burke? I'm a little autograph book. So it's exciting times.
Yeah. No, it's been good fun. We've got a great cast. Adam Deacon, Yasmin Akram and Samuel Anderson, all of whom have done TV and film and stuff. So I feel slightly more at home than I would normally in the theatre, which is a bit of a different world sometimes.
Okay. So tell us about it. What's the play about?
Oh, the play. It's a comedy about Buddhism. So it's about a guy played by Samuel who's on retreat, doing a meditation retreat, and his ne'er-do-well brother, played by Adam, bursts in to kind of talk him back down off his mountain, back to reality. And Yasmin is doing a retreat also nearby. So.
Fantastic. Where did they come from?
It came from my experience of doing lots of meditation retreats.
Okay.
Which is kind of one of the provenances of Peep Show, because those thoughts in your head that drive you crazy, that's what you hear all the time on meditation retreats. So it kind of informed what me and Jesse were doing with writing ridiculous voiceovers for Mark and Jeremy.
Okay. And so are you deliberately striking out on your own, as I said in the intro there? Because you've written a couple of things now without Jesse Armstrong for...
Yeah, we are still hanging out and seeing each other, but... We are doing more solo stuff. Like I did Ill Behaviour, which is coming to Showtime in a couple of weeks, and he's doing a series at the moment in New York. And yeah, we're doing more apart, but we're also doing stuff together as well, like a film we're trying to get made at the moment.
Okay, excellent, excellent. And so the Park Theatre is a very interesting venue. I don't know if anyone... Have you guys been there?
No.
Yeah.
No.
It's really good. I love it.
Yeah? What have you seen? What have you seen
there? Oh, I don't remember. It was ages ago. I saw something set in Maine in the woods, and it was about sort of the weird people who lived in this little small town. It was really good.
Sounds like the Blair Witch Project. Are you sure it wasn't the Blair Witch Project?
I'm 100% certain, because it wasn't terrifying and shaky cam.
Yeah, I've seen a few things there. I didn't really go that often, Sam, I'll be honest with you.
Because you're too busy going to see films.
I was too busy going to see films, and I don't know, it felt too far away.
Well, let's face it, most of the time film and TV are better plays.
Yes.
I'm trying to rebalance
they
that.
They are. The last thing I saw there was Ian McKellen.
Yeah.
A one-man show with Ian McKellen.
Because you've seen him in a film.
I have seen him in a film, so I knew what he was going to be doing. And it was amazing. So he was trying to raise money, because he's a patron of the Park Theatre. Mm. And so he was raising money, because it's publicly funded and whatnot. And so he did this it was Gandalf and other characters or something like that. And so it started off with a black stage and a chair, and darkness fell. And all you heard from the darkness... You shall not pass! And then there was Ian McKellen on stage with a copy of Lord of the Rings, his copy of Lord of the Rings that he annotated on set.
And the crowd went wild.
The crowd went bananas, including a very drunk woman who kept heckling him.
Really?
Whoa.
Yeah.
Heckles Ian McKellen.
She thought it was crowd participation. It really wasn't. But that's the thing about the park, because it's a 200-seater theatre. Mm-hmm. It's in the round. And
pretty much.
And... yeah, does that change how you approach the play? Because presumably you wrote the play, and then the park said we'll put this on.
Yeah, yeah.
Does that change how you approach it?
Well, it's doing live theatre is a lot more terrifying than doing anything on screen, because I'm going to have to be confronted with the reality of the audience, which no one really wants to face the actual audience, right? It's better to imagine all the amazing people watching your stuff, not actually seeing them yawn and cough and eat crisps. during your precious play.
It's the Park Theatre, Sam. There's going to be high quality peanuts, not crisps.
Yeah.
It's going to be kettle chips.
No, I am slightly dreading it, but also excited at the same time.
Yeah. Oh, fantastic. I wish you all the best. We'll chat a little bit more about other stuff as it goes on. But we're gonna go with the show as per usual. Which means we start off with a question. And the question has been sent in this week via Twitter by @arapley1. Alejandro on Twitter, and he asks, in tribute to Sam and his partnership with Jesse Armstrong, who is the second best writing or / creative partnership in cinema? And Sam, you said you've got two answers for this.
Well, it's a good question. I was thinking about it, obviously, in advance, because I like to think about things before I say them in general.
Oh, you'll never fit in here. Yeah. Oh, dear.
Just while you're sitting by the door. Honestly, just leave.
Get out.
And I think, on the whole, comedy writing is where you find often the most strong partnerships. I mean, obviously, you get drama people, Coen brothers, Wachowskis, etc., yeah, doing great stuff. But me and Jesse obviously write comedy together, and there's a long tradition of doing that. I think because you bounce off each other, because there's like a healthy competition to make the funniest line. Mm. And so often that's the case in TV and film. So I was thinking about my sort of favourite comedy films, and two partnerships jumped out.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them, and they're both with famous directors, and I think the co-writers often get overlooked for that reason.
Yeah.
So first is Billy Wilder and I.A.L. Diamond.
Damn it, that was my answer. Genuinely.
And
sorry,
mine.
I should have compared notes.
No, you go ahead.
I'm like wearing your dress, figuratively speaking. Because they obviously direct Some Like It Hot, yeah, and The Apartment and The Front Page and loads of brilliant films. And, you know, he's not I.A.L. Diamond, which is a hard name to say. Let's face it.
It was Ian.
Let's call him Ian. But he's not as lauded as Billy Wilder for obvious reasons,
yes,
but obviously those scripts were written by the pair of them. And the other partnership, which is similar in that respect, is Woody Allen and Marshall Brickman.
Oh, yeah.
Who wrote Sleeper, Annie Hall and Manhattan.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And again, he's not a guy that people talk about.
That's right, yeah.
Because they think of Woody because he's the star and the director. But, you know, I'm sure that he was a hugely important part of all those films. You don't get writing credit if you weren't.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a cracking choice. That's one I was going to say as well. Damn you, Sam. Jimbo.
Oh, God.
Do you have one that's going to steal Helen's thunder one more time?
Well, obviously, Aaron Sorkin and Aaron Sorkin would be my favourite pairing.
If I had to pick himself.
I'm going to go with Ben Elton and Richard Curtis.
Really?
Yeah.
I did not expect that, but we were talking about Blackadder on the way
over
here.
Yeah, I mean, I'm famously an enemy of fun and comedy. But
he really is. Everyone.
It's lost on me because I have no sense of humour. But Blackadder just totally defined humour for me as a growing adolescent. And when we saw Journey's End recently, which is, you know, I think we kind of agreed. We think it might have been part of the inspiration for Blackadder Goes Forth, because there's so many beats that are similar. And the play, Journey's End, was written in 1928, I think. So it's been around a long time. But it's so good, and I watched some more of Blackadder Goes Forth this week, actually, because it was in my head, and it's so funny and it's so sharp.
We should make clear, Journey's End is not itself
a comedy. No, it's not a comedy in any way. It's so bleak and depressing. But nevertheless, they are related.
I see.
So I'm gonna. That's going to be my pick.
That's a really interesting one, especially since that is a partnership where you can see what one party brought to it.
Mm.
In that, obviously, Richard Curtis, you know, he wrote The Blackadder with Rowan Atkinson, didn't he? It was Rowan Atkinson, and was it someone else
so.
As well? Was it
just
Rowan
I can't Atkinson? Remember.
And then Ben Elton comes on for Blackadder 2, and suddenly the joke quotient just flies up.
But also the humour, the nature of the humour, it becomes much more caustic, much more sarcastic and less kind of pratfall-y. It's a very different sensibility, Blackadder the second is, and it really came into its own, because The Blackadder is not great.
No, I'll go with that. It feels almost like a reboot with Blackadder 2. That's a good shout. Has anyone been watching Upstart Crow? Sam, have you watched?
Yeah, very funny. Obviously, David Mitchell being brilliant. And I'm really pleased that it's doing so well for Ben, because he got quite a kicking on his last show, which I'm sure wasn't much fun.
Yeah, he did. I think Upstart Crow is fantastic. Have you watched it, Helen?
Not yet. Yeah? Keep meaning to.
It's really good. It feels like Blackadder, but it has its own vibe and it has its own personality as well. And David Mitchell's fantastic.
Mm.
Really, really great. So check it out. It's about Shakespeare. It's about it has a lot of the benefit of hindsight powers a lot of the scripts, which it's very, very funny. I've written down here, well, I've got it on my phone, Lowell Gantz and Babalu Mandel, who is really strange, but for like there was a period in the late 80s and early 90s when they seemed to be the kings of American comedy, and I imagine they were probably script doctors in a lot of movies they weren't credited for, but they were the writers on Parenthood and City Slickers and films like that, and they just seem to be the go-to comedy guys. And I think you're right, Sam. I think it, by and large, is comedy guys who work in teams. So those two for me, I'm not saying that they're my favourites, but certainly they're a partnership that springs to mind whenever I think of the of comedy partnerships or writing partnerships. Hell's bells.
Well,
now your thunder's now, been stolen. Now you've been banged.
I would actually put in the Coen brothers in that category as well, because they are very funny when they're on form.
Yes, they are.
They're very, very funny, and it feels like even when they're being dramatic, they're being incredibly wry and making jokes that we just haven't got yet. So I would probably put them up there, actually.
The Farrellys also, whether or not you like their sense of humour, very, very good at that, I would say.
I mean, you can say that. That's,
you're not a fan. Well, I mean, okay, so
no, I get what you're saying.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. I'd also throw in, of course, Sucker Abraham Sucker for comedy.
Lord Miller.
Lord Miller.
Not so much as a writing team, I would say, because they don't get full credit on their movies as writers. Mm. I think they work very much as directors. I think you can talk about this in a modern way without acknowledging Edgar Wright and Simon Pegg, mm-hmm. whose scripts are works of art as well, I think, in terms of, you know, their deployment of foreshadowing, and you know, their just ability to set up a joke in minute one and pay it off in minute 97 is amazing. Yeah. Hot Fuzz for me is their best script. But The World's End, you know, that film probably gets a bigger kicking than any of the other films they've made. But as a script, as a piece of writing, it's really, really fantastic. And I really like the work that Will Ferrell and Adam McKay do together.
I was thinking of that as well.
Those guys knock it out of the park.
When they're on form, they're really on form. When they're not, they're, you know, not.
They're never off form. Mm-hmm. Name one bad Will Ferrell, Adam McKay movie.
You can't.
You just didn't. In fact, you failed. But Sam, I just want to bring it back to you and this idea of partnerships. You and Jesse, who paced and who typed?
Well, I think that the pacing and typing thing is probably more with actors you write, because for me and Jesse, we're both sort of writers. We're not performers. So we both did the writing. Essentially, the reason we lasted for so long, 20 years, is we sort of share the weight equally. We do all the same sort of
Would you be
jobs.
In the same room, or would you
In
write?
The same room to do, like, storylining, mm-hmm. and then go away and write the dialogue separately and then swap.
Okay.
And re-edit each other's dialogue.
How fishy did that get?
Well, you know, I think, you know, one of the key things to having a functioning writing partnership, and probably a functioning marriage, which is a different question, is sort of letting go of your ego and actually going, well, the partnership and the work is more important than what I think. It's more important to focus on what the script needs rather than whether it's my joke or his joke.
Okay.
And that did kind of make it work for so long, I think.
I thought of two more, and you're going to be impressed. You're going to be impressed that I waited until now to mention them.
All right. Oh, is it Sam and Dean from Supernatural? That doesn't count.
Oh, such a good call. But no, it's the Russo brothers and Marcus and McFeely from Captain America.
Okay. All right. The Russo brothers. They're writing team?
No, they're directing team, but it said creative partnership.
It didn't just say writers. I just kind of ignored that first part.
Yeah, I know you did.
Yeah. Okay. All the brothers.
All the brothers.
Except the guys who did Aliens versus Requiem. Aliens versus Requiem? What is that? Aliens versus Predator, Requiem. All right, I will accept your answers.
Thank you.
And we shall move on. If you want to get in touch with us on the Empire Podcast, you can do so via a number of methods. You can do so via Twitter, as Alejandro did. Use the hashtag Empire Podcast, or chances are we won't see it. You can Facebook us as well. I don't even know why I say Facebook. We never check it. But, you know, if you do want to Facebook us one of these days, and I might see it, and we might put the question out in the old podcast.
Why don't we make a pledge that this is the week we're going to check Facebook?
You say that, and then you open the Pages app on my phone, and it's awful. It's just, there's so many messages, and I can't troll through them all. But yes, okay, I'll try and do that for next week. I'll try and pick a Facebook question for next week. And you can email us as well, we're podcast@empireonline.com. All right, time now for this week's first guest, or should I say guests. Brawl in Cellblock 99 came out last week in cinemas, is also available on demand, which means streaming services and iTunes, that sort of thing. You just can't go into McDonald's and demand it. That would be weird. It's director S. Craig Soller, or Craig, or Soller. He likes to be. He doesn't really mind what he's called, as I discovered. And its star, Vince Vaughn, are a force to be reckoned with. And they've already wrapped their second movie together, Dragged Across Concrete. It'll be out next year. I cannot wait. I spoke to them about the hair-raising violence, or the face-scraping violence, more likely, of their prison movie, and much, much more. Enjoy. I saw this film in the manner which you intended, Soller. I watched it on my computer on a screening link, and I loved the film. But
the ideal screening situation.
Utterly regretted it. Well, it says my name on it, so I think it looks like the star of the film all the way through. Yep. Well, that's nice.
That version was dedicated to you. What's your name again?
I want to give a shout out.
My name appeared to be a property of Universal Pictures.
Oh, property of Universal Pictures.
Yeah, which is
all right.
Pretty,
property.
That's pretty much right. Yeah. But I really, really want to see this film. I'm making it my life's work now to see this film with a crowd, because I have heard stories from people who see this film with a crowd and there are oofs and what the fucks, and there are security guards who are men who have seen shit in their lives, I'm sure, who are going literally Jesus Christ at the things you do in this movie, Vince. It's an astonishing experience. Did you know it was going to play out this way with an audience when you were crafting it?
I think I come from a place of writing the stuff that I want to read or see in the case of a script that's going to be a movie. And I'd seen these prison movies at Film Forum. This was maybe like 2010, 2011. Started thinking about conceiving something like this. And then I just was thinking like, man, movies like Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia, which might be the best movie title of all time. Death Wish, First Blood. Where are the movies like this?
Yeah.
That's sort of an adult guy movie. And that was where I conceived all this sort of stuff. Now, the other elements fold into what it is I'm very, very interested in drama and subtle performances and layered performances. And Sidney Lumet and John Cassavetes are two of my favorite directors, and so then I'm interested in that stuff as well, and so that starts coming in. And then there's the reality that I grew up as a kid of Fangoria with like pictures of eye gougings and eviscerations on my wall. Like my mom would come into my room when I was a kid and she had to take off her glasses because she couldn't actually look around, and so I was just like the blurry kid with some shit in his room.
Yeah.
For a really long time. And so that's in there. I'm also a massive fan of soul music. And so that's in there. Also, I study Kung Fu. I'm not particularly good. Vince Vaughn is certainly far, far, far my superior at his studies in jiu-jitsu. But I'm interested in it really mainly from an aesthetic standpoint. And so the history of movies in terms of showcasing performers, going back to say Buster Keaton, and then to Fred Astaire and seeing him dance head to toe in his movies, and then Jackie Chan, and all these people, and seeing all this stuff happen on set on the day, and when you're watching these movies, these performers are doing it. So fold that into all of the other stuff I'm talking about in terms of the performers are making it happen, and there's the drama, and there's the crazy gore, and there's the soul stuff, and there's the independent drama. And once you start stacking enough of this stuff, I guess this is, you pass the threshold of it seeming insane to normal human beings. To me, it all makes complete sense. And I watch them like, of course that's where this needed to go.
Yeah.
But I understand you're stacking enough completely different viewpoints and interests that in the end land in this, what the hell did I just watch, experience.
Buckle up.
Vince, how are the... we won't get into details at this point about the insane shit that Bradley does in this movie, but how is it described in the script when you're reading it?
It's the best thing I read. I mean, I remember... I love Bone Tomahawk. I thought it was incredible. And that was the kind of thing you're like, where is this movie going? Like, what happened? Like, it's kind of funny, and now they're talking. Oh, I like these characters. This is really good performances. And then this is, what? They got to go where? And it's complicated. And then it's like these, it's like Sierra Madre. They're arguing and what's happening. And then all of a sudden you walk into this almost alienistic or spiritualistic Indian situation. And I remember, like, there was just things in that movie, like, they're leaving, and there's these pregnant women in cages, and they just walk by them. They're kind of captured women that have clearly been kind of tortured and have things put through them, and they just kind of move on. And I just thought, this movie is really fascinating and very well done. And so I have that context in reading this screenplay. I remember getting to the stage where it's like, the guy beats the car up, and I was like, "Oh, this guy's got. This guy's like not trying to act cool. Like this guy's trying not to kill somebody. Like this guy's hurt. He's getting his girlfriend away from him, and he's violent. And now he's going to the house." And I thought, "Oh, what is this? Is this is it gonna?" And then he sits down, and he's kind of accountable for his participation in the downfall of the relationship. And you know, without giving away too much, they haven't handled the relationship well. There's clearly a want of sobriety on both people's ends. So this is a sexual relationship. It's a friendship, but they're kind of a support system. They're almost family to each other. Like, this is a very dependent relationship. And the fact that you come out of it kind of rooting for this couple, that actually there's some pain and some mistakes made, I just was surprised by it. And then it's literally a morality tale. The die is cast. You make a decision for reasons I can understand. But nonetheless, you still have made a choice that there's going to have to be some consequences for. Mm-hmm. And then I was just constantly surprised. Oh, this is what it – oh, wait a minute. Now this is the turn I'm waiting for. And now that's not what's happening. It's this. Yeah. And now this happened. And I'm involved in these characters. There's an emotionality to these characters. And yet I'm just having a lot of fun and being surprised with turns. And there's something really great to me, honest to me, about a man who's not totally innocent – but has no choice but to do what he needs to do, and it's not pretty.
Yeah,
and it's kind of badass.
Yeah, it is. In terms of the script, though, I mean, when you're reading it, is it? Do you write an arm is snapped and the bone goes through the skin? Do you write that? Do you when you're reading that, Vince? Do you see that for the first time?
You get the idea. This graphics. This is very graphic.
Yeah,
yeah. There's a lot of detail. I dealing with the studio system, I learned to just cheat the shit out of my margins and shrink the fonts, and that goes to the top of the page and the bottom. I've been hiding how long my pieces are forever. And part of it isn't that just the pieces are so long; it's that the amount of detail I put in there exceeds what's normal. So the stuff you asked about specifically, like a bone popping, that stuff's in there. Apart the car, moment by moment, that's in there, and
that's amazing.
The detail for that stuff is there, and that's the roadmap when we're all on the set trying to make it, which is even better if any of the crew people bother to read it.
Do they not bother? They just skim it.
We shot this in 25 days. It was a challenging shoot.
It's a hell of a role for you as well, Vince. Did you leap at it with both? Did you grab it with both hands when it came your way?
I was excited because I trust his taste so much. I love Bone Tomahawk, so I was excited. I kind of in my mind wanted some to do different things and some challenging things. So this was a lot in one. So first and foremost, I love the story, and then the character. You know, I had definitely going in a healthy sense of fear.
Yeah.
And in talking to Craig, I would say, well, do we need to do this or this? And it was sort of that. Before you jump off, realizing just to what degree you're going to have to commit. So, you know, physically I had to get in the right kind of shape and get much stronger and kind of just a strength way, not necessarily like a cut or, you know, this is a guy who works but is strong.
Yeah.
I had to revisit boxing and get very comfortable, fluid with moving and punching. The accent, although I have in my history, Southern roots, I can slip into it, but I had to be specific and really dial in with someone on that to have consistency. The emotionality and the character background. Craig wrote a bio.
Yeah.
There's some very extreme, you know, you read these scenes and they're clearly extreme emotional scenes, but you have to kind of put yourself in a place where you're in the headspace this character's in and then kind of just react in the moment. So there's a bit of a, it all happens and kind of, there's a trust that happens, like you can't over prepare. So there's just that, right? There's a moment, like you get there on the page and it's like you're ripping a car apart.
Yeah, or, of course.
There's a scene with your that's extreme. People are going away or things are happening, and you just have to kind of trust on the day that you're gonna be present and that the preparation is there.
I mean, obviously you've done a lot of comedy in your past, but you've also done other stuff. You have done dramatic roles, straight roles. You've just come off True Detective, of course. Is there a sense that you know that Hollywood's been trying to put you in a box for a while, and you've been pressing against the confines of that
box. The man has shoved me in a box,
property
man.
Property of Universal Pictures.
No, you know what it is I think you get rewarded. Like when I first did Old School, they were like, yeah, I don't know that he can be funny because I hadn't done a lot of broad comedies.
Yeah.
And that was a challenge for Todd to give me that part. And then I went on this run of like, some of these comedies were really fun and defiant comedies and art comedies. And then I think I got comfortable and started like, you know, people start putting you in the same stuff and you're doing it. And I think as you get older and I have the luxury now, I sort of was sort of like enough. I really want to do things I'm excited about. I want to try to do different things. This is why I became an actor. So I think I opened myself up to that. And just fortunately, yes, True Detective and then Hacksaw Ridge with Mel.
Of course, yeah, yeah.
And then this thing, which is just spectacular. I mean, part of the fun of this movie is there's comedy in it. There's action in it. There's really emotional scenes. There's phenomenal music, and there's just some bizarreness of these kind of things coming together. So it's such a unique film.
Yeah, yeah.
It was just so fun to be a part of something. Like when we started with Swingers, we sort of were like, well, these guys listen to swing music, and this is how they talk. And we went through the same steps where people were like, you can't make this movie. It's not for everyone. It's too strange. And of course, that became something that got into the culture.
Yeah, of course.
And this is where Craig is working from with Bone Tomahawk as a fan, and then being a participant in this and Dragged Across Concrete. He's got a very original voice. He's writing things that he finds unique. And then the rest of us are kind of catching up to why those things are fun.
And then I just have to wrap up by asking about Dragged Across Concrete, which, you know, from what I know of, it sounds incredible. What can you say about it? What can we expect? And we can expect it fairly soon, this time next year, maybe, I'm guessing.
This time next year is probably a pretty good guess.
Yeah. Probably in the same hotel room we'll be doing this again
right.
Next year.
I finished doing quality control on Brawl in Cell Block 99, and 5 days later was in Vancouver prepping Dragged Across Concrete. And it is kind of like the way that you'll know Brawl in Cell Block 99 was written by the same guy who did Bone Tomahawk, but it does these different things, Dragged Across Concrete as well. And that is, it's more of an ensemble piece where you have these partnerships and these relationships between adult men that that are put in various crucibles with situations of the public eye, violence, and criminal activity. So I don't want to say too much on that one. But, yeah, I mean, it's Vince, Mel Gibson, Tori Kittles, and Michael Jai White. And, you know, getting to work with performers like this and bring out all the friendships and the relationships of all these characters was really enjoyable. And in that way, a little bit more along the lines of Bone Tomahawk, where it was this ensemble. And sort of some of the character development is more like the relationship development between these different characters. And really, really fun to do. The plotting is a lot more complicated than that of Brawl in Cell Block 99 and Bone Tomahawk, but I am quite confident if you're on board for one of these, you're on board for all three.
And the title seems to suggest brutality once again. Vince, is Dragged Across Concrete a movie you're going to be one to watch with an audience for the oofs and the what the fucks?
I just think it's so cool. It's very different. I mean, there's similarities, but I was just surprised where the screenplay went. I couldn't predict it, and it all made sense. It's very, there's a lot of great character stuff in there. There's a lot of surprising stuff in that movie. The violence in this stuff, of course, is unique and specific, but it unfolds a world and a universe that's quite spectacular.
Okay.
There's a visual component to that movie and world discovery as you enter into it that becomes fascinating.
Sold. One ticket, one screening
Buckle
link.
Up.
One screening link to Property of Universal Pictures. That'll be me next year. Soller, Fawn.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you so much, dude. Thank you.
Cool, thank
Appreciate
you.
It.
Cheers. That was S. Craig Soller and Vince Vaughn. Cracking movie. If you haven't checked it out, do so. And if you're wondering where Jeff Goldblum has got to on the podcast, because I mentioned him last week as one of this week's guests.
I was wondering, where is he?
We had such a good time with him. He came in last week. He came in last Friday to the pod booth upstairs. And we had a blast with him, as you would expect, because he's Jeff Goldblum, and he was very Jeff Goldblum-y. So we decided to make that a special. That's an interview special, and that should be out round about now. just as soon as we finish recording this, and I record an intro for that, and it'll be up.
Excellent.
There you go. So he is, of course, in Thor Ragnarok. We'll be talking about that later in the show. Sam, have you seen Thor Ragnarok?
No, I'm looking forward to it.
Okay.
I've been prevented from seeing it, but my wife is not in the country. She wants to see it with me, so
okay.
I'm having to wait.
Because you tend to keep up with the Marvel movies, don't
you?
Yeah,
I'm a fan. And of that studio, I think I've consumed all their product.
Do you wear the t-shirts?
Not quite.
Okay, you don't go that quite that far. I do.
What's your top tier Marvel movie?
I think Civil War, actually.
Good choice.
And you mentioned the writing partnership. I think it is a really, really well written screenplay.
It
really
is
well structured and surprising, and the way it sort of turns the sort of genre conventions on their head is really exciting. I think
it's the rule of threes. So Captain America 3, Iron Man 3, Thor 3, all the best.
Spoiler.
Captain America 2.
Oh, nonsense.
No nonsense.
I'd probably say Winter Soldier, Bentley, Civil War.
What's wrong with you people?
But, like, by an inch. I mean, you know, it's not...
It's not a lot. And Iron Man 3 is the best one.
Yes. Yeah, it is, yeah.
All right, so what are we talking about? Jeff Goldblum?
Yes.
All right, so he's on the podcast. Yes, anyway, so Thor Ragnarok, and we'll be discussing it later on in the show. It's very good, Sam.
Yeah, I can't wait. I did have the pleasure of meeting Taika Waititi a few years ago at Sundance, and he was a very charming, funny gentleman. So,
yeah,
looking forward to checking it out.
Yeah, no, it's good. It is good. You will like it a lot. And we're going to discuss this week's movie news now. I don't know what the hell's been happening this week. I haven't really been paying attention. So, Helen.
Hi.
What's happening?
Well, there are exciting rumours. I think we can call them little more than that at this stage, that there may be a Logan spin-off focusing on young Laura, played originally by Daphne Keane, X-23, real name Laura Kinney, whatever you want to call her. She was obviously a clone of Wolverine, has her own metal claws, and is a force to be reckoned with. And there is apparently a script that James Mangold is working on, who obviously directed Logan, and that the great success of Wonder Woman has helped to make a thing.
Indeed.
But there's nothing more than that yet. We don't know anything more than that.
How do you feel about this?
I feel positive, with the slight worry that she is so good in that role, I don't want anyone else to play it, but she is a kid, and I don't know if they'll go with a kid in that leading role. So it's going to be interesting to see how that goes. I don't know.
So it's just speculation. You said originally played by Daphne Keane. So
it is speculation entirely speculation that whether she'd be back or not.
Give it half an hour and we'll know, because our John Nugent is on the phone to Daphne Keane as we speak. So,
amazing.
You know, presumably he'll ask her.
Fingers crossed.
But yeah, I'm excited.
He may not.
In fantasy, he may entirely forget. So, assuming he does tell her, we'll find out. I really like the character of X-23. I know she's a little bit maligned in the X-Men universe, but my worry about this is does this film potentially take something away from Logan? You know, I really like that as an encapsulated thing, and I like her in that film, and I almost don't want that bubble to burst.
But then I think it depends on how well it's done, and the fact that James Mangold is the one writing the script, because he was so passionate about getting that tone right and getting that feeling of finality for Logan, that's got to be a good thing in terms of not ruining it.
Well, let's
in
hope.
Retrospect. Not ruining it in retrospect. You can't. We have Logan. That's in the box. We're taking that home.
No, George right? Lucas has proved you can absolutely ruin things in retrospect.
Oh, I mean...
Okay. You've opened a can of worms there.
Yeah. It's a whole other discussion.
Back away from the... Back away.
But Craig Kyle, who originally created the character, is apparently working with Mangold, and Hugh Jackman will not be involved even as a producer. So that door has closed for him. He is out.
They're sick of Jackman. Get out, Jackman, as he comes round banging on the door, demanding to be involved. We don't want you.
Things literally no one has ever said. There, Chris. Thank you.
More concrete, though, they've announced a second season officially confirmed for Star Trek Discovery, which I'm very excited about. Sam, have you watched the new Star Trek?
I haven't. Is it good?
It is good, actually. It's very good. I think there were some odd reactions to it initially, because it doesn't feel like classic Star Trek, but there's a reason for that, because it hasn't, you know, the format hasn't really aged. I don't think in this kind of age of peak TV, classic Star Trek wouldn't really fit in that format. So they've updated it. It feels much more like the movies. It's incredibly cinematic, and it's very dark, and there's all sorts of swears in it as well. Which
there
is
are
unexpected.
Swears, and there's Jason Isaacs as the captain being a little bit dodge, which is not what we expect from a Starfleet captain.
I have to say, I got to hold my hands up here. I haven't seen Star Trek Discovery yet. I'm a little bit scared of the swear, I'll be honest with you, which is weird being being Irish. Regular listeners of the show will know I'm not afraid of the odd swear now and again, but in Star Trek, Really?
Not even in Klingon.
Is it star swearing or normal
swearing? No, it's normal swearing.
One of the characters actually says something on the lines of, it's fucking fantastic, and everyone looks at her, and then the other character goes, no, you're right, it's fucking fantastic. So they make quite a meal of it. Wow. But it's on streaming, I guess, they can get away with it.
It's that kind of... the camera.
But it is that kind of...
and wink.
It is that kind of casual swearing. It's not like angry swearing, which would be very un-Star Trek. It's sort of enthusiastic swearing, which kind of seems more, you know, a bit more Geordie LaForge, a bit more Scotty. Like, oh, we've done something, isn't it great?
Right.
I read
an interview with Jason Isaacs was talking about shooting it, and he was saying that he'd improvised a line on the bridge, and he'd said Jesus, and they'd stopped it and said, you can't say Jesus. Say Jesus, because we're in a universe where religion has kind of been pushed aside, and it's very secular. And he said, well, can I say fuck? They said, absolutely, you can say fuck. That's not a problem. You just can't say Jesus. And action. which I thought was a nice moment. But no, my thing about Star Trek, which I thought was quite interesting, is the pilot, a full third of the pilot is in Klingon with English subtitles. Which is bold. Mental.
Mm. Although you can get Klingon subtitles if you'd prefer.
On Netflix, you genuinely can.
Oh, that's good to know. Now I can watch it.
I know.
In the original Klingon. Yeah.
It was pretty, alienating otherwise.
But the thing I should hold my hand up to, I want to re-examine this in a second, is I got it wrong by Jason Isaacs.
You did.
But did I get it entirely wrong about the show's intentions? I'm not so sure I did. I won't say too much to spoil things, but I was convinced that he was going to bow out by episode 4 in a kind of Sean Bean in Game of Thrones, whoops, spoiler, or what's her name?
You're going to ruin something else now.
Yeah, absolutely. Spooks, the lady in Spooks who does all the cooking.
Yeah.
Now, what's her name? Lisa Faulkner. Thank you, everyone. thanks for the assist. Lisa Faulkner and Spooks, so the big star name that the show is going to be built around. Oh no, they've been pushed into a deep fat fryer, and that's not good. I thought it was going to be, that was going to happen to Jason Isaacs.
Deep fat fryer
in space, which would be terrible. But it hasn't.
Well, I mean, as we learned this week, the replicator that creates the food for them on the ship advises healthy choices, so would be against deep fat frying.
Actually true.
Absolutely. Sam, you Trekkie Trekker, Trekkerino, whatever it's called?
I have trekked. I'm not a committed trekker.
So you're more of the movies guy, or do you dip in and out?
Reruns of the original series as a kid, and that kind of stays with you. You know, I always have affection for that primary coloured universe. Mm. Yeah, I've watched a few of the movies. I enjoyed the J.J. Abrams reboot.
Okay, okay. With no swearing in that one.
There isn't any.
There's no swearing. There's no swearing in Star Trek. I'm having a hard trouble with this.
Yeah.
I'm really having a hard time. But I just wanted to talk to you very quickly about swearing, because you've done some creative... You've been behind some creative swears in the past.
Thank you.
How do you come up with creative swearing? What's the process for that?
I guess you're thinking about things that people show, like, I don't know, cock muncher and words like that, and piss kidney, right? Is that what you're thinking about?
Yeah, never not funny.
Yeah. Is there a formula? You take...
No, it's just like all the swears have been taken pretty much, because obviously as humans we love to swear, English humans in particular, so it's like must be something new you could say.
Right.
Because swearing is one of the most fun things you can do with words, right?
So it's big and clever.
Yeah, I think so. There's an art to compound swearing, though, isn't there? There's something genius about that. You know, whether it be douche canoe or cockwomble, or, there's something inherently funny about putting stupid words together like that.
Can you just put any words together? Can you just look at this and go, this is a microphone, wank mic?
Blade Trinity is still the high bar for me. It's the cock-juggling thundercunt. In Blade Trinity, I thought that was just you.
It's hard to improve upon.
He's used it literally daily since.
Yeah. We had someone write in a couple of months ago saying, I love the Empire podcast and I like to listen to it with my 8-year-old son. However, since James Dyer has started appearing on the podcast more regularly, I can no longer listen to it with my 8-year-old son because of your potty mouth.
Sorry.
You wank mic. I'm trying to make it work.
Yeah. It's not going to happen.
It's not working. All right, so here's a bit of news I've just read about.
Sure.
It's very exciting. Ben Mendelsohn's going to play a bad guy. I know this is a shock.
No, surely not.
I don't believe it. I won't.
There's casting against type and there's going too far, I would say.
And it's in the MCU as well, so you're going to really suspend the disbelief and go, oh no, Ben Mendelsohn's a bad guy. I didn't see that coming. Yeah, he's in talks to play the chief villain in Captain Marvel, which is obviously out in 2019. Obviously, as everyone knows, which is out in 2019. And he, according to, I think it's Variety that broke the story, or Hollywood Reporter.
One of the two.
Variety. Okay. He's going to play a Skrull oh, those Skrulls. Skrulls, if you don't know what they are, they're shape-shifting alien bastards that are being introduced into the Marvel Cinematic Universe as a Captain Marvel. And as I suspect, they're going to be behind a big kind of retcon of things in the MCU.
No.
But that's exciting.
It is, yeah.
That's exciting. We like him.
And the directors, Anna Boden and Ryan Fleck, worked with Mendelsohn before on Mississippi Grind, which is
a film I love.
Really good film.
I'm very evangelical about Mississippi Grind. Mississippi Grind is fantastic. If you haven't seen it, do check it out. He is great in it. And he's not a bad guy in that either.
No, he isn't.
Guy.
Although that's almost a spoiler. The less you know about him going into that, the better, I feel like.
Yeah. Anyway. So when he shapeshifts halfway through, it's a real surprise. So what else is happening? Anything else?
Renée Zellweger is going to be playing Judy Garland.
She should win.
That's a thing that's happening. I don't know. I can't. I'm trying to put them together, and I'm having a little bit of trouble with it. But I'm sure she'll be very good.
She's a very good Judy Garland actress, right?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Even so, so it's a film called Judy. I feel like they haven't done a lot of work coming up with that, but that's okay. And Rupert Gould is set to direct the film based on a script by Tom Edge, who was involved with The Crown. So it's basically set in 1968 as Garland's going to London for a 5-week series of concerts. 47, just wanting to be home, not interested, and under pressure, basically, is the idea. So the worry is whether the show will go on or not, I believe.
Wow.
So, good to see Renée Zellweger getting a, you know, what sounds like a pretty meaty role, because I feel like she's been quite quiet in the last year or two since the last Bridget Jones. So it'll be exciting to see what she does with it. But I don't know. I would never put them together.
I can't say I would either. But, you know, she's good.
Yeah, she's good.
Positive.
Yeah.
In other positive news, Vincent D'Onofrio is confirmed for Daredevil Season 3. I'm very excited about that.
That is excellent news.
He is back.
He was the best thing in any Marvel series, obviously.
He was 100%
phenomenal, yeah. I mean, he made the Season 1 of Daredevil was fantastic because of him. And then it all got a bit... I mean, Season 2 was all ninjas and nonsense. And
a lot of ninjas. There's a ninja overload. They obviously bought a lot. They bought, like, a sort of family pack of ninjas. And I felt I had to use them all in many returning series.
And they really did for 13 hours. It was very tedious.
You're right, because then he shows up in Daredevil Season 2 for one episode as special guest star.
Yeah, and makes you realise why you haven't enjoyed it so far.
Yeah, and just acts everybody else off the screen and bangs Matt Murdock's face into a table and yells at him and you're just going, this is what I need. I need a big bald man yelling at me. Hey, Jimbo, how's it going? All right?
Not dissimilar to this podcast.
I think with good casting, sometimes those comic book films and shows can really elevate a character to make it actually better than it is in the comic. I'd look at Tony Stark in the movies as actually much more interesting than the character in the comics.
Mm.
And same with the Kingpin. I think they did him so well that he kind of makes you feel like it massively improved on the source material.
Mm. It feels like they stepped away from what they tried to do. I always felt with that first Daredevil, with him in particular, it had a really serious sort of realism to it, sort of a dark edge, because he was very believably psychotic. He was a very nuanced, complex character.
Mm.
And then they seemed to backtrack into more sort of safe comic book territory with Season 2, and frankly with all the others, like Jessica Jones Season 1, again, it was dealt with very interesting themes about consent and control. And then, you know, Iron Fist, Defenders, they become very generic. And very generic over 13 hours is really fucking generic.
Again, as an 8-year-old, you've just ruined it again.
Sorry, well, I've ruined Defenders for him as well, so, you know.
No, I think other people ruined the Defenders.
Yeah, I couldn't get through that series, to be fair. No.
Given that it's 8 episodes, it's pretty damn.
Well, I'm the only one I've not made it through is Iron Fist. I even made it through Luke Cage, but Iron Fist just did for me. Couldn't do it.
No,
Hello, my name is Helen, and I've seen them all.
Wow.
Well, you know, respect, basically. But yeah, I heard the bad vibes coming off that show. I didn't try it out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you see them all for work? In the way that I saw Batman v Superman: Dawn of Justice 4 times.
Four times. You get some sort of medal or crown.
Or medical assistance.
Yeah. So you had 4 Marthas in your life. Wow. Impressive.
I have to say, and here's the thing, I don't know whether it's Stockholm Syndrome after a while, but I began to think, when I watched the Director's Cut, which is 3 hours long.
Of course it is.
And has way more Martha than the original.
Really? Is there more Martha?
It's just Batman and Superman yelling Martha at each other for a good 10 minutes.
I could watch that, definitely.
You begin to think, you know what, okay, this is not the film that we wanted, but this is a film and that it is, and I have to judge it on its own merits, and it's okay in parts and quite good in some.
This is a man who's suddenly starting to turn himself around as prison food, being forced to eat it for 4 years. Actually, you know what? The peas and the potatoes are pretty good here.
This cup of water, which is literally a jar of piss in a Superman movie. Holly Hunter gets blown up, and then she's looking. Well, there's a spoiler. Anyway, okay, I won't talk about that.
It's a podcast about films. We have to have some.
I know, but people
content.
Get so angry with me when I spoil films.
They're not real people. They're just people who listen to your podcast. That don't count.
As with The Defenders, that film has been well and truly spoiled before you got near it. So.
Yeah, okay, fair enough. What were we talking about?
It's hard to say.
I've lost the run of myself a little
D'Onofrio.
Bit.
D'Onofrio. We span D'Onofrio. Off from D'Onofrio. Yeah. That's a thing. Good, yeah.
He is so good, and he's so intense. He's good on Twitter. He's very good on Twitter, is old Vincent D'Onofrio.
He doesn't takes no prisoners on
he
Twitter as well.
He takes no prisoners. You know who's good on Twitter?
You.
Des O'Connor.
Oh, God. So this is about you.
Oh, yeah. Oh, have I mentioned that? Des O'Connor, the giant of chat shows, the legend of light entertainment that is Des O'Connor, he's just followed me on Twitter. He's probably unfollowed me already as I unleashed a knob gag.
God.
But Des is fine. He's okay. He hung around with Stan Bortman. He knows how to take near the knuckle humor. He's fine.
Wheeling it back to actual news.
Oh,
there's only one Thank other goodness. Thing I can think of, and that's that Gareth Evans is doing a comic book movie about Deathstroke, a character whom I have never heard of because I don't read DC comics. I hope that's been educational.
That's
there you go.
Super helpful. He's actually in Arrow season 1.
Of course, he is.
Where he's played by Manu Bennett, and he's very good. Was it season 1 or season 2? I don't know. They all blurred
he's
after
by
a while.
Manu.
Manu Bennett.
He's played Manu. Interesting. I like Manu.
And he's good in it. I quite liked him in it. He was quite scary. So he's a sort of mercenary turned super mercenary, I guess, is probably the best way to put it.
You know, long lost husband Joe Manganiello was going to play him, am I right in saying, when he was the villain in The Batman? But presumably
yes.
isn't necessarily playing him in this.
Oh, unless they're still linked, which we just have no idea about because the DCU is not entirely
coherent?
Consistent, I was going to say, with those kind of decisions.
Okay. Good.
They're making it up as it goes, like one giant super improv class.
It is.
It's pretty cool.
With capes.
This is interesting. Gareth Evans, of course, has said in the past that, you know, he wants to do his own thing, but I guess at a certain point, maybe you want to strike out and play with the big bucks. And he's in talks at the moment.
Yeah, but he came in with an idea that apparently impressed them enough to make this thing rather than something else. He was brought in for a meeting about Justice League Dark, apparently, and came out with in talks for this. So something impressive happened.
So he went
in the
to
middle
buy a
there.
Cow and came out with some magic beans.
Yeah, so we could be looking at a great beanstalk of comic book fun.
It's exciting. It's good. Sam, are you into the DC stuff at all then?
Well, I find, the films, I don't really read the comics apart from the obvious ones like The Dark Knight and Watchmen that everyone read, Alan Moore stuff in the 80s, but the films I find a little bit hard to get enthusiastic about. They seem a little bit all over the place, tonally. Mm.
Did Wonder Woman turn you around a little bit?
I tell you what, I really enjoyed Gal Gadot, who I've never seen before, in Fast and Furious or anything. I thought she was genuinely impressive and a star performance, but the film turned into a bit of a CGI mush at the end.
Yeah,
there was some great stuff in it. It was funny and different. Yeah, I enjoyed it.
CGI mush. Put that in the poster.
I know you are, but what is it?
But Gareth Evans is fantastic. I think he's probably the best or one of the best action directors on the planet, and it's, you know, I'm not surprised that people have been trying to snap him up for ages. So,
yeah
more power to his elbow. Shall we class the joint up a little bit? Because it's all been spandex and superheroes and, well, Judy Garland. The trailer hit this week, finally, for the long-awaited return of Paul Thomas Anderson and Daniel Day-Lewis.
Yes.
Phantom Thread, not a sequel to The Phantom Menace, Jimbo. I was as disappointed as you were. This is about a fashion designer, Reynolds Woodcock, played by Daniel Day-Lewis in his last movie, going out with a real cracking name.
That's Rick Owens.
Yeah. Jefferson Mike Wank.
No, it's still not happening.
Damn it. I'll make it happen by the end of the podcast.
God help
I'm
us
editing
all.
This. I'm just going to loop Mike Wank for a good half hour solid. So he's going to play Reynolds Woodcock, and he gets involved in a torrid affair with a waitress, I think, that he sees at a B&B or a hotel. And it all looks very mannered and precise, as you might imagine.
Anything Paul Thomas Anderson does is worth watching. Mm. Anything Daniel Day-Lewis does is worth watching.
Multiply it together
and you've got something that's probably okay.
And Sam, we've got to let you go in a second because we've got to start talking about movie reviews and we don't think it's fair to have you comment on your
films
peers' work.
Seen yet.
And films you haven't seen yet.
I can make up opinions about films I haven't seen yet.
All right, so we're going to very quickly talk about Thor Ragnarok. What's your opinion on that?
I think it had far too much cooking in it. And I don't think there was enough of the big dialogue scene when they're all sitting around the table talking for 3 hours was good, but it could have been a bit shorter.
Sounds like you have seen it. And, let me have Andy Serkis's Breathe, which could be an Oscar botherer.
Yeah, too much CGI mush in that one.
Yeah, he can't help himself. He was in a mocap suit the entire time, and he was a director. So weird. Note: I'm going to let you get back. You're in rehearsal right now. You're tweaking the retreat.
I'm tweaking like a pill popping addict, and twerking like someone in a Beyonce video. You know, it's fun, but also nerve wracking.
And Kathy Burke is directing this. The great Kathy Burke.
She's a ledge. What can I say?
Yeah. How did that happen?
Well, Jonathan Harvey, who wrote Gimme, 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 mm-hmm. and is a good friend of Kathy's, suggested, because he knows he's looking for a director, suggested I sent it to her, and lucky enough, she liked it and wanted to do it.
What's she like as a director?
She's fantastic. I couldn't praise her more highly. She is a national treasure, and she is exactly what you'd hope she was. Very mm-hmm. outspoken, but very, very good at what she does. And she loves it. You know, directing's her passion, really.
Does she approve of your twerking? Your constant twerking? You've barely stopped.
She's the one who suggested it. She said, I want you constantly twerking. And I'm, you know, if she says I have to do it, then that's fine by me.
You got to go for it. I was going to let you go, and then I just saw one last bit of news. Can I just throw one last bit of news in?
Mm. Sure.
Yeah, screw it, why not? Doctor Who's new companions.
Yeah.
Doctor Who's new companions were announced this week. So we have, and one of them was a big shock. And I think has caused a lot of contention and nervousness amongst the Doctor Who
This is
fans.
The one who it's the guy I'd not heard of who's from the show I've never heard of,
That's
right?
correct, James. Okay, yes, good. Well done. Yeah, with your finger on the pop culture pulse as ever. So we have Tosin Cole, who's going to play Ryan. We have Mandip Gill, who's going to play Yasmin. Bradley Walsh, who's going to star as Graham. Bradley Walsh, for those who don't know, and I'm speaking specifically to James here, is a stand-up comedian turned actor, turned quiz show host, turned light entertainer. Is he as good as the legend of light entertainment it is, Des O'Connor, my latest follower on Twitter? I don't know, but he's up there. He is a platinum-selling music artist. His album Chasing Dreams was number one last year.
And he's the star.
I'm his agent. I don't know so much about Bradley Walsh.
And he's the star of the modern update of The Running Man that you were telling me about.
No, he is the host of The Chase, which is a quiz show on ITV in which a bunch of brain boxes take on members of the public. And he's the host, and he brings it all down with his, you know, to ground with his laddie, earthy humour.
Wow.
Uh-huh.
By brain boxes, do you mean boffins?
Boffins. Yeah. Mike Wanks, if you will. So he's going to be in Doctor Who. And people are up in arms about this.
Well, he was the one who was announced, or at least rumoured, months ago.
Was he?
Yes. Just after Jodie Whittaker was announced as the new Doctor.
Hang on, there's a woman as a new Doctor? What the hell?
It's PC gone mad all over the place.
Spoiler
it's outrageous.
Come on, guys.
Yeah. My problem with him is one of the dancers on Strictly this year looks almost identical to him, and I can't tell which is which.
That's a legitimate objection.
Just get him to sing, and you'd soon know who's who.
Of course.
The one with the voice of an angel, of course.
Being the dancer
the person
from
that
Strictly.
You think that's correct. There we go. All right, on that note, Sam, it's been a pleasure. It has been a pleasure having you. Good luck going back to Finsbury Park. Do pop into my old haunts. Have you been to Season, the restaurant?
No, I'll check it out.
It's really, really great. It's Drag Green Road. Say hello to the owner. And Max's Sandwich Shop, which is up by Crouch Hill.
Why are they laughing? That sounds like a great shop.
Because it suddenly sounds like I've suddenly started promoting all these businesses that I have no financial investment in.
Empire Podcast is brought to you by Max's Sandwich Shop.
Max's Sandwich Shop is fantastic. It's up by Crouch Hill, so it's a little bit of a walk up from the park.
A little bit of a walk.
And they're big sandwiches.
Oh, worth the walk.
£8.50.
It really does sound like £8.50 for a sandwich.
Wait, I know you're sounding
VAT.
This is insane, right? £8.50 for a sandwich, but these things are mothers. They're huge. They're right. amazing. He only does four kinds. He's revolutionized.
What are the four kinds?
The four kinds. There's there's a ham, egg, and chips one, which is amazing.
Chips.
Yeah. There's a chicken one, which has got stuff in it.
Like a whole chicken.
There's a beef one. There's a vegetarian one. But and it's really, really great. And he's a top, top man. So pop in, say hello to Neil from Season and Max from
Max's Sandwich Shop.
There you go.
With the ham, egg, and chips.
Tell him I sent you. It gets you no discount. It gets you nothing of any kind.
I look forward to the blank look.
Chris Hewitt from the Empire Pot.
Do you want which sandwich do you want? I'm busy. It's lunchtime.
Do you want the ham, egg, and chips one? Honestly, yeah. That's £25, please. Anyway, it's been a blast having you, and good luck with the play.
Thank you very much.
And come in and bother us again one of these days.
Love to. Thank you.
Fantastic, Sam Bain. Thank you so much. Okay, now Sam's gone. I've raced back up the stairs, which is why I'm out of breath. Oh my God. Too many sandwiches from Max's Sandwich Shop.
With the egg and the chips.
With the egg and the chips. Although he lets me take out the Piccalilli. Sounds wrong, but bear with me here.
Never do that in public.
So the sandwich comes with it's ham, egg, chips, and Piccalilli smooshed together with some focaccia. It's absolutely amazing. It's amazing. It's the best sandwich I've ever had. And I initially tried it with Piccalilli. I'm not a great Piccalilli guy, and he doesn't let any other customer take out the Piccalilli because he's very precious about his sandwiches, is old Max. He lets me take out the Piccalilli.
I feel like you may be overestimating how interested we are in your sandwich habits, but...
What? Oh, you should be listening to my other podcast.
That's right.
That's the one. Okay, sorry. I completely forgot which podcast I'm on.
Sandwiches with Chris.
I thought I was on the sandwich podcast.
Or is it called No Piccalilli, Please, these days?
It's a working title at this point in time.
Okay.
Right, so let's have time. Let's have time for a second guest. She is Claire Foy. She is one of our finest actresses. She could be seen, of course, in season one of The Crown as Queen Elizabeth II, and will soon be seen, of course, in season two of The Crown as Queen Elizabeth II. And she will soon be seen, of course, I'm saying of course a lot, she will soon be seen in The Girl in the Spider's Web as Lisbeth Salander.
The girl who did an inadvisable thing, generally speaking.
Okay, yeah. The girl who did something. She's going to be playing the new Lisbeth Salander. And she will now be seen, of course, in Andy Serkis' directorial debut, Breathe, which is out this week, starring alongside Andrew Garfield. And we sent along, I want to say Helen. I'm looking at Helen.
I think it was me.
Was it you?
It was me.
It was Helen. Helen, what did you talk about? Just give us a quick...
We talked about Breathe, the directorial debut of Andy Serkis, in which he stars opposite Andrew Garfield.
Did you talk about Max's Sandwich Shop?
We did not.
Okay, well then you've failed.
I'm so
sorry.
You
failed as an interviewer. All right, so here we go. Here's Helen O'Hara talking to Claire Foy about stuff that's not anything to do with sandwiches. What the hell's that about? Enjoy.
Well, we did actually talk about Breathe, the directorial debut of Andy Serkis, but we also talked about the fact that, and you'll hear her discuss this in the interview, she had a very sore neck. She woke up with a trapped nerve or something and is holding a sort of an ice pack on her neck. So if you hear a strange rustling sounds during the interview, it'll be the ice. So.
Wow.
We hope she's gotten better since.
And it's not her rustling some paper that's housing a sandwich.
It is not, no.
It's not. Okay.
No sandwiches were consumed during this interview.
Oh, this is such a shame. So here it is, Claire Foy, Helen O'Hara, meeting of minds. Enjoy.
Well, welcome to the Empire Podcast, and I'm joined today by Claire Foy. Hello.
Hello.
So this evening, you open the London Film Festival with Breathe.
I do.
You know, obviously, if it goes wrong tonight, then the whole festival, I believe, has to be cancelled. So,
no pressure.
No pressure.
I've never opened a film festival before. I mean, I'm not doing it on my own. There will be, you know, several other people.
A couple of others, yeah.
But yeah, no, it's amazing. It's incredible. It's a very, you know, we shot it here. We shot 3 weeks in South Africa as well, but it feels like a very, very British film. And I'm really proud of it. So it's great. It's very exciting.
And it sort of came together in a very serendipitous way, didn't it? That yourself and Andrew and Andy Serkis just had a break, like a very short break in all your very busy schedules.
Yeah, I knew that Andrew was doing it.
Right.
And obviously was like, oh my God, I want to do that. But I had decided that I was having just a long old holiday, and that's what I was doing. And then this came along and I was like, well, I can't say no to it. I just can't say no to it because I'd read the script by that point. And that was the biggest mistake because I was like, oh my God, because it's such a beautiful, beautiful script. And then they were like, okay, well, if you sign on, then we're going to start prep and we've got 6 weeks. And I don't think anyone has ever got filmed together as quickly as they have to get the finance as well. Everything. They did everything in 6 weeks. Which is pretty incredible. And they made it work. I think there was a point where they were like, oh my God, this actually might not happen. And Jonathan's been trying to make this film for 10 years. So as soon as he had the option that it was going to work, he was like, I'm going to make it work. and it all somehow miraculously came together.
Yeah, it does. It does seem that way. I mean, and it is. It's such a personal story because Jonathan is Jonathan Cavendish, who is your character's son. Mm-hmm. So this is the most personal possible story.
Yeah, it is. And I think for that reason, you think it would probably be quite intense and really, really specific. And we were trying to get everything exactly right and blah, blah, blah. But he had very little ownership of it. He was so... It wasn't really like making a film. It was genuinely like telling a story. And I really feel like part of the family. They really, you know, I've met his kids and his mum. And so it really felt like a different kind of thing to me. It felt like an experience, not a movie. He was on set every single day and he was so helpful. And he never said, oh, that would never happen and that would never happen. But behind the scenes, he was saying, oh, you know, we had that sort of telephone, not that sort of telephone. And he was incredibly helpful to Andrew, I know, because obviously Robin's no longer around. And so he's very much like his dad, Jonathan. So he was a real help. But yeah, the only thing he really did not like was me and Andrew kissing. So whenever there was like a kissing romance scene, not that there's that many, he was like, oh, no, like facing in the opposite direction and stuff. Like, I was like, we're not actually your mum and dad. Like, pack in, grow up.
I mean, I guess it's flattering that he, you know, reacted so viscerally.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I think he thinks I am his mum. So he's got two mums, although one of them is, you know, it would be, I don't know how that would mathematically have worked out.
Time traveled Sarah Connor kind of thing, I guess.
Yeah.
And the real Diana is still with us, isn't she? And so
she,
you met
very
her.
Much is, yeah.
So what was she like?
She is, as you would imagine, she's no nonsense, incredibly humble and strong and adventurous and you know, if you can spend half an hour talking to her, it's half an hour well spent. She's just an amazing woman, and she doesn't view what she's done as amazing in any way. She just thinks that it was completely the most natural and right thing to do for her. She loved her husband so much, and so she doesn't see it. The last thing she would want to be is a saint or a martyr, and unfortunately she is a bit of a saint, but a very human one. You know, that's why the film's so true to them. They approached everything with humour. Everything was through the, you know, the prism of thinking, oh God, the worst has happened, but here we are. Oh, here we are. You know, it's not about kind of, oh, this is terrible, let's, you know, get down in the dumps about it. They just made a joke and they cracked on.
I do think that's true to a lot of disabled people that I know. You know, a family friend had MS and they were always making jokes about it that we wouldn't have done from as outsiders to the family, but they were hilarious.
Well, I think it's anyone who's suffering. Like, I think, you know, in my experience, anyone who's actually afflicted with an illness or anything like that wants to make everyone else feel comfortable, first of all. And I think very much with this specific disability that Robin had, in the sense that he had a breathing apparatus, he had a respirator that was breathing for him. He was very restricted in the way he could speak and how long he could speak for. You know, his thought process had to be until the end of the machine, and then he had to break and then carry on. He hated being interrupted. And I think ultimately by doing that, you want to make everyone else go, don't treat me any differently. Stop it. Like, you know, I don't need to be mollycoddled or mothered or anything like that. And that's why Diana and Robin were incredible, that they made life harder and more difficult, and they couldn't travel as far as they wanted to travel and all those sorts of things. And there were different elements to it that at times would be entirely overwhelming, and you'd think, why me, and the world is, you know, wretched. But actually they just went, oh, you know, the worst has happened and we're still here. And they everyone who came into contact with them was just amazed. And, you know, there's a scene in the film where Robin is surrounded by women, and all of them are in love with him. And that is what it was like in real life. He was constant, everyone was in love with him. And I think that's why Diana was just felt so lucky to call him her husband. And she was so honoured to know him and be with him. And everyone was so honoured to know them. They're just an extraordinary pair.
And how about Andy? Because he's a first-time director, but he's got a little bit of experience in the film industry. So he's probably, complete neophyte, I guess.
Oh my God, no. I mean, you would not. It seems ludicrous to me that this is. I mean, it's not his first film because he'd done Jungle Book before. But I suppose it's his first release.
Yeah.
Sorry, if you can hear loads of water sloshing around, it's because I've got a hot water bottle on my shoulder because I've woken up with a crick in my neck. So I apologise about that. But yeah, so it didn't feel like his first film at all. He's so assured. And he has every right to be because I think he's directed so much before. And he just was a friend, really. He was a friend to have around, and he supported us and encouraged us and encouraged everyone, had boundless energy and vision, and he really, really wanted to make this film and this story.
Yeah.
Not just for Jonathan, but he just was like, this is it, this is life, this is everything. So I'm very, very proud that he trusted me enough to do it, really.
Did you get him to do the Gollum voice at any point?
No, I didn't. We did have one hilarious moment where I don't know whether Diana was. I think Diana was there. My God, we were at Pinewood and Andy was shooting something very secret, and we weren't allowed to know what it was. He was like, he's going to pop in a minute, just to the rehearsal, just to have a chat. And we were like, okay. And then next we know we get a knock on the door, and Andy walks in entirely in like a black leotard with spots and dots all over his face, on his lips, on his teeth, on his nostrils, like. As if it was completely normal, and everyone was just like, no, we can't have a conversation with you looking like that, like some talking about kind of a really honest true love story, and he's there with all these kind of like CGI markings on his face. Mental, absolutely mental.
Amazing. So you've also got The Crown season 2 coming up. This is your farewell to the role. You seem to be okay with it, from what I've read. You seem to be philosophical and at peace with
it. Yeah, I would. It would have been weird if I'm not, really, because I've known about it the entire time.
True.
I think if they'd have just done season 2 and they'd gone, actually, you're out, love. I would have been, aggrieved and probably quite angry. Mm. But instead, I'm just like, well, no, this is what it always was. This is what we signed on to. And so for me, it's the natural life of it. So it ending, it makes sense. And I'm like, yeah, it's supposed to. And it's supposed to reincarnate and it's supposed to become something else. And I can't wait to see what they do. I can't wait to see what they do with it. I think when it comes on again, I'll probably be at home silently crying, going, what a wonderful thing to have been a part of. Because then you know it's over.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's not mine anymore. But it will be wistful, but it won't be sad.
Yes. And you've got some other exciting stuff coming up. So First Man with Damien Chazelle. Yep. I mean, I find astronauts endlessly fascinating. So that's a pretty exciting role again.
Yeah, I'm not one, unfortunately.
I mean, no, sadly.
I mean, that would be interesting though, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
If they just decided to put a woman up there.
Yeah. Neil Ella.
Yeah. Nigella Armstrong. So that's ridiculous situation that I'm in that film. But I am, apparently. So I go out to Atlanta in a couple of weeks to do that, which is amazing.
Oh, fantastic. So is that, you've also got The Girl in the Spider's Web coming up. So is that after?
That's after, yeah.
Wow. So have you started thinking much about that yet, or are you kind of just slow build?
It's going to have to be slow build.
Yeah.
But I'm going to have to be very clever with my time. And I don't want to get confused and one day on set be finding myself doing a Swedish accent in a film about the moon landing. So I'm just going to take it steady and, slowly catching monkey.
Yeah. And does that feel like a big sort of change for you, because you've been in a number now of mid-century kind of biopic related stuff? Does it feel like, let's just go for something completely different?
I think I Breathe was a really hard decision in a weird way, because I felt like her and Elizabeth were really similar in lots of ways, and I was a bit like, well, and I was like, oh God. And the option was, well, if I don't want, I'm just not going to do it, because that's a bit scary. I was like, shut up. So I just had to just sort of say, don't be ridiculous. Obviously Janet Armstrong is a departure for me. She's from Chicago, so and that's a completely different setup and everything like that. But I, you know, I feel like actually, weirdly, Elizabeth Salander is more like a lot of characters that I've played before. So I'm returning to the dark side, I feel like, ever so slightly. I feel like I've been in the region of sort of good, honest, kind-hearted people for far too long. I need to go back to black, I think.
Back to black. Yeah. What a good thought. Well, listen, I better wrap it up. Just before we go, mm-hmm. I believe you've been working with Steven Soderbergh as well. Has that been done already, or is that coming up?
That's been done. That's long in the can. Yeah, we did that ages ago. Yeah.
So can you tell me anything?
No.
What's he like?
Oh, amazing. Oh, God, I love him. He's an absolute one-of-a-kind maverick genius, film genius. Just is everything that you want a filmmaker to be. He just doesn't care about reputation or what's expected or what should be done or how it should be done. And that's why he's endlessly changing and constantly able to, you know, with the way that film and TV and everything like that has evolved, even since, you know, since I started, since he started, it's changed beyond recognition, and he's not afraid of that. And I think that's just, I just think he's marvellous.
He is bad at retiring, though.
He's great at retiring because he just goes, I'm retiring. No, I'm not. I'm retiring again. No, I'm not. So whichever way you look at it, he's done pretty well at retiring and then just going, actually, I'm not done, guys. There's more I can do. And that's why I feel like there is more he can do. And that's why he's pulled back to it, because he's like, I'm not done. Mm. Yeah, I want to be Steven Soderbergh.
So any directing plans then?
Dear God, no. That would be a disaster.
All right, well, Claire Foy, thank you very, very much.
Oh, thank you very much.
All right, so that's Claire Foy. We'll be talking about Breathe in just a second, but now it is time to breathe, because we'll be talking about Thor Ragnarok, which has been out in this country since Tuesday, October 24th. It's not out in the States yet until November 3rd, which is why our Thor Ragnarok spoiler special won't be hitting until November 6th. I sat down last week with the director, Taika Waititi, and we went through the film in a fair amount of detail, some interesting answers. And we'll be getting to that next week. But we didn't discuss the film in last week's podcast. So now it's time to get into it. Who wants to tackle it? Who wants to tackle this film?
We've all seen this. We should all tackle it together.
Yeah, James, you wrote the review.
I'll be the Hulk, Helen can be Thor, and you can be Valkyrie.
Seems reasonable.
Yeah, I think that's good. Excellent. Let's continue.
Can I...
Valkyrie's one of the best things in it. This is a compliment.
She's very good, but can I not be... like Loki?
You're not a Loki.
I am.
Sorry.
I am.
Relentlessly mocked in every scene. Yeah, that's okay. You can be Loki.
Fair enough.
Wait a minute. Okay, I've misjudged.
So, Thor Ragnarok.
Yes. Yes.
Tell us, James, about the story.
The story to Thor Ragnarok. This is the third of the Asgardian standalone adventures. And this sees Thor. I'm going to avoid spoilers in this, because when I wrote the synopsis in the review, I dropped a massive spoiler in it, which I didn't think was a spoiler, but it turned out was a spoiler.
What did you say?
I can't say it because it's a spoiler.
We'll discuss it on the spoiler special.
We'll discuss it on the spoiler special. But I
mentioned, has it since been amended?
Yes, we changed it. So
did this go out to the public? This spoiler.
My spoiler?
Yeah.
My spoiler didn't. The other publications did.
Because didn't you do a spoiler in another review recently?
Yes, that was War for the Planet of the Apes. I also spoiled that.
Okay.
I have a long-standing tradition of spoiling things in the plots of my reviews.
And that's something that happened in the first 10 minutes of War for the Planet of the Apes.
Well, see, this is my thing. I think if it happens in the first 10 minutes, it's not a spoiler, because it's part of the prologue and you're going to see it in 10 minutes. What difference does it make?
It depends. I was specifically told that something that happens in the first 5 minutes of Stranger Things 2 is a spoiler.
Really? In the first 5 minutes?
5 minutes.
That's not a spoiler.
I wouldn't have said so either, but there you go.
Okay, well, people are sensitive about that. So let's just say that Thor returns to Asgard. Because as we last left Thor in the Dark World, Loki is on the throne.
Maybe we shouldn't discuss this film.
No, we shouldn't discuss it. Loki is on the throne. He is currently replaced Odin. So Thor goes back to resolve that situation.
Yes.
And then... a thing happens, and after that thing happens, they encounter Hela, who is the goddess of death, played by Cate Blanchett, and she is very powerful, and for all intents and purposes, kicks them both off the Bifrost, and they end up on the junk planet of Sakaar, where Thor is condemned to the fighting pits and reunited with an old friend.
We won't say
from
who
work.
That old friend
from
is.
Work. Yes.
But in case you haven't seen any of the trailers or the posters or any of the publicity around this film, we won't say who it is, because it's a Hulk.
It's
literally
the
Hulk.
Yeah,
damn it.
It's the Hulk.
It's a banner moment in the film.
It is.
It's not really, not for ages.
No, this is true. But he does leave a nasty Bruce. bruise.
And hey,
this film,
yes.
And we've discussed this a bit, and we didn't entirely agree on this. I stand firm on my statement, which is this, that this, all of the Marvel films have comedy in them, and they are action films leavened with comedy. Sometimes, like Ant-Man, they have lots of comedy in them. To me, this is the first Marvel comedy. This is a comedy film which happens to have action in it, and I think it's genuinely the funniest comedy of the year. I think it's brilliant. Loved it.
Ooh, I think it's maybe the second funniest comedy of the year because I love Death of Stalin.
You're not the first person to say that.
But it is phenomenally funny, this film. And I think that is going to trip some people up, and I think there are going to be people who criticise it on that basis, because it kind of rushes through the action and it rushes through the emotional bits and it rushes through the plot to get to more jokes.
And in really emotionally heavy bits, they'll drop gag after gag, which kind of diffuses some of the potency.
It does, but there are such good gags that it's really hard to care.
Yeah, it's very funny. Very, very funny. And it's just, honestly, it's genius. I mean, it's vintage Taika Waititi, isn't it? It's very, it's not just really funny, it's quite quirky in that very sort of Kiwi sensibility he has. And what surprised me most about this film was how much freedom Kevin Feige gave him to just do his thing. You know, he wasn't reined in. And there is this thing, and Feige's talked about it, where, you know, they have a template for the first film. They understand what they're doing with the second film. And on the third film, they let the franchise breathe a little, take a few risks, go a bit nuts. But this is proper nuts
in the best way. Yeah, because Iron Man 3 is my favourite of the Iron Man movies.
And it is the best.
On a given day, it can be my favourite Marvel movie, full stop. Civil War, yeah, that's interesting. Thor Ragnarok is my favourite of the Thor movies by a country mile. Mm-hmm. I think it's probably the funniest Marvel movie. In fact, I said it on Twitter, and I said it to Taika Waititi in the interview, that it's the funniest movie by a mile. It's really interesting here for comedy, for me, from my point of view. I liked The Death of Stalin. I didn't love it. I certainly wasn't convulsed with laughter throughout. I found it far too dark and destabilizing for that. Which, again, yes, I know, is the point. The movies that have made me laugh most this year are not quote-unquote comedies, and they are, weirdly enough, Guardians 2 and Spider-Man Homecoming has some amazing jokes
in it. Yeah, that's true.
And these movies seem to be picking up the slack where big screen comedy in the States is failing. Mm. So this year we've had a number of big comedies fail at the box office and flail at the box office, and some of them have been absolutely terrible. Baywatch is still one of the worst movies of the year by any measure. And along come these movies, which, you know, aren't comedies, but they have joke after joke after joke. And here's the interesting thing. I may have seen this movie 4 times. That's not an indication of how much I like it. I really do like it, but it's not top 5 Marvel for me. It's top 10 Marvel for me. I really, really like it. But I saw it twice for the spoiler special, third time because I was hosting a Q&A with Taika Waititi, and the fourth time I took my drinking game buddy, my wife, to see it last night with an audience. And the jokes that made me laugh out loud first time still play in the same way the fourth time.
Yeah.
And they are absolutely brilliant jokes. And Chris Hemsworth is hilarious in this film.
Yes, he is.
Hilarious.
And I think he's had moments in the first Thor and in the second Thor, you know, when he improvised hanging Mjolnir up on the coat hook. There had been moments of comedy genius.
That was improv.
That was improv, yeah. But here, they really tap into him. And, you know, he's done comedies. You know, he did that god-awful Vacation film and he did Ghostbusters. But I think he's learned...
He's brilliant in both of
them. Yeah, and he's learned a lot. And I think he's got real confidence in his comedy, and that comes across in this film. Yeah. But to get to what you're saying about how, you know, these films are kind of, you know, laughing, as it were, actual comedies off the screen, I absolutely agree with you. And this is something that I've often gone back to, which is that, for me, like, pure comedy in that very heightened, surreal comedy world doesn't amuse me in the same way as comedy juxtaposed with drama does, which is why I find The West Wing so funny and why I love the sort of 80s, you know, Eddie Murphy stuff where they're action comedies, that the action makes the comedy funnier.
But it's also comedy that comes from character.
Yeah.
And it doesn't feel to me like there's a lot of improv in this movie, and some of the funniest things in this movie that slay me fourth time round are derived from improv, but they don't have that desperation feel that you get with a lot of American comedies, a lot of the worst excesses of the Judd Apatow staple, for example, where you can just feel people just going, all right, let's just throw out a few alts and we'll see what happens. And we couldn't decide what to use in the edit, so let's just use them all and see what happens. But comedy in this movie, for the most part, comes from character. And there's a lot of great stuff that pays off things that are set up 5, 6, 10 movies ago in the MCU that just are brilliant punchlines now. I can't spoil it, but, you know, there's an amazing reaction shot when a certain character sees another certain character who may have slammed that character into the ground. And and it's just, it's very, very funny and pays off in unexpected ways.
Also, massive props to Mark Ruffalo, who is not only hilarious as the Hulk, but incredibly funny as Banner as well, when he transitions from Hulk character to straight man and funny in two different but equally hilarious ways.
Yeah, I blooming great. And also, I mean, Tony Stark manages to get laughs without being in the film, which is impressive.
But we are going to end up recording a spoiler special now if we're not careful. So should we just say it's brilliant? We gave it 4 stars.
It's fantastic.
For me, it is top 5 Marvel, and I think it is by far and away the funniest Marvel movie.
That's interesting.
I definitely recommend people go and see it.
Ellen, where's the sit for you?
Probably just outside the top 5.
Okay.
There's so little room.
So you're still Incredible Hulk, Doctor Strange, Ant-Man, Iron Man 2. And Guardians 2.
That's the one. I'm a big fan.
Don't forget the First Avenger.
Don't forget. The First Avenger
is genuinely in my top 5. Thank
Actually
you very
kidding.
Much. I am not kidding.
Ye gods.
Listen to the Star Spangled Man. Do not knock it. And a bit where Hitler gets punched repeatedly and... Who wouldn't want to watch that?
Who doesn't love it?
4 stars in for Thor Ragnarok. We will be getting into it in big time on the spoiler special. And a lot of people have written into me already and said that they love the humour, but conversely found it really off-putting.
Mm. I can understand that. Yeah. I can understand
if you
take it all seriously, you might jar with you, but you're wrong. So, you know.
Next up is a real peach of a film. It is the second Hammer-based film of the week, actually. That just popped into my head. Bit of improv there.
Very good.
We'll keep it in.
Yeah.
Just Judd Apatow's editing this podcast, so we're going to keep it all in. It's the latest from Italian director Luca Guadagnino, and it is positioned as an early frontrunner. It is called Call Me By Your Name. It stars Armie Hammer and Timothy Chalamet, and which I'm probably pronouncing really, really badly, and Michael Stuhlbarg. Hell's Bells, tell us all about this.
Yeah, so this is set in the kind of early 1980s, and Elio, who's played by Timothée Chalamet, I think, is living in Italy with his parents for the summer. He's got this sort of charmed life. He's confident, he's outgoing, he's smart. Everybody likes him, you know. He maybe overestimates his own maturity, but he's kind of got life set, it seems. And then Oliver, who's played by Armie Hammer, comes to spend 6 weeks working with his father, who's played by Michael Stuhlbarg. And feelings kind of grow between them, basically. It's a very slow-burning, you know, gently building romance. Elio's completely transfixed by this guy who, you know, let's face it, is basically the sort of Calvin Klein-esque ideal of the American preppy man. It's kind of a dizzying romance. You've got the two of them sort of falling for each other. They're kind of aware that their time together is limited. And so there's a sort of a pressure, but at the same time, the sort of scaredness to actually act on it and actually move forward. So it's just an amazing kind of tightrope walk of emotion the whole way through. And while it's rarely kind of vocally emotional, when it is, it's really, really impactful. This is a film where you should be prepared for the sort of the traditional three hanky weepy for this one. It's just got so much emotion going on. It's absolutely joyful at times and emotionally devastating at times, and just great performances from Chalamet and from Hammer in particular, but the rest of the cast as well.
So you think this will be bothering Oscars?
I think it certainly deserves to be. It certainly deserves to be, yes. And I think it'll be interesting to see whether it gets that kind of attention. It's an interesting Oscar race this year, isn't it, really? Because you've got a lot of films that have a lot going on, but very few of them feel like traditional Oscar contenders at this point. And, you know, something like Three Billboards outside Ebbing, Missouri, great, great film. It doesn't feel to me like a traditional Best Picture winner.
Yeah.
And so I'm a little bit intrigued to see what happens. But certainly in terms of quality, in terms of performances, in terms of just a brilliantly put together script and gorgeously directed piece, it absolutely deserves to be in that conversation, and I hope it will get some of that attention.
Fascinating. And surprised to see, of course, that Suicide Squad's being re-released this year just so it can win Best Picture. And finally, get that other Oscar in the bag.
Good Lord.
So five stars. We loved this
five
film.
Stars. Yeah, absolutely deserved.
Loved this film. Call Me By Your Name. Five stars for Call Me By Your Name. Another movie I think will be bothering Oscar in the not too distant future, certainly in the acting categories, is Andy Serkis's directorial debut, Breathe. And there's a fascinating story behind this film, Helen. You can fill us in on that one.
Yes, there is. So the producer of this film is a guy called Jonathan Cavendish, and the story of the film is actually about his parents. So his father, Robin Cavendish, who's played by Andrew Garfield, was newly married to Diana, who's played by Claire Foy, and was working in Africa in the late 1950s when he contracted polio, and it hit him in such a way that he was basically left paralysed by it, and dependent on, and this is the key point, he was dependent on an artificial respirator to stay alive. Now, in those days, that meant you were confined to a hospital bed and you were given a lifespan of months. And that was kind of, that was it. And what's interesting here is, I mean, he's initially suicidal. He has huge problems adjusting to this new life. You know, a guy who's incredibly outgoing and adventurous and active is suddenly confined to bed for the rest of his very short life. But Diana, who's just given birth to Jonathan at the time, is determined not to let him go, and it keeps fighting to find ways to make his life better. So they gradually, they get him out of the hospital to their home, first of all, so she can take care of him there in the house. Then they find a way to, you know, get him more mobile. They find a way to build a respirator into a wheelchair so he can actually move around, he can travel again, he can get out of bed, essentially. And it's a really beautiful story about love and devotion to each other in the couple and in their sort of wider family and friends. A really, you know, again, a good look at disability and humanity and, you know, how the two are very closely tied together. So, I mean, there's echoes of the theory of everything just in terms of they face some of the same challenges. But once again, it's a story really about a relationship rather than about an illness. And that story is just brilliantly told. It's great, great performances from Garfield and from Foy in particular. And really good work, I think, from Serkis. I mean, it's a bit, you know, it's a bit cozy. It feels a little bit Sunday night TV. It's not going to break any new kind of barriers of cinema.
Sure,
but yeah, I don't think that's what anyone set out to do. I think they set out to tell a very warm-hearted, sincere story of, you know, courage and compassion. And I think that's what they've done. So I rather enjoyed it.
And we gave it?
We gave it three stars, three just stars. Because of that hint of sort of Sunday night TV.
Yeah. You may have seen this film before, but just in slightly different guises.
Exactly. But it'll stay with you.
Yeah. So there you go. Three stars. But hey, what do we say in the podcast?
That is a recommendation.
That's what we say?
Yeah. Pretty sure.
You sure?
We've done a few of these now.
Okay. I should write this down somewhere. So we say, when we say three stars, what we're saying is, you're going to like it. Is that...
That's what we're saying.
Three stars in for Breathe. And also out this week, and also getting a three-star treatment, is the Grace Jones documentary Bloodlight and Bami, and the South Korean thriller The Merciless. I haven't seen either of them, but three stars for both. So, you know, hey, what? Recommendations, and go and check them out if you can.
Also
Stranger Things.
Oh, Stranger Things.
And well, before Stranger Things, also Jigsaw, which we now have a review for, which
do
I haven't
we?
Read, but Jigsaw, we go three stars to.
Three stars.
Our own Kim Newman gave it three stars and said it's better than being sawn in half.
Well, there you go.
He didn't say that at all.
This is Jigsaw. We'll be talking to Tobin Bell in next week's show. And so Jigsaw is the eighth Saw movie, and it wasn't screened to press, and it opened today when we recorded the podcast Thursday, and so Kim went to see it. It's filed this review double quick time because he's Kim Newman, he's a legend. Three stars, directed by the Spierig brothers, who did Predestination and Daywalkers? Day Sleepers? That's an R.E.M. song. whatever it's called. The one with Sam Neill and Luke. Who's Luca Hawke? Ethan Hawke. Anyway, I'm a host of a movie show and I should know what I'm talking about. But anyway,
Daybreakers? Was it Daybreakers?
Daybreakers? Is that it?
I think, do you know what? I now don't remember.
Daybreakers.
I want to say Daywalkers, but now I'm thinking of
Wesley Snipes,
yeah.
Yeah.
Some motherfuckers always trying to ice skate uphill.
Yeah, some motherfuckers are always trying to play a Dejan Lovren in the center defense.
That's a little bit obscure.
It's a niche one there.
Yeah.
Anyway, Stranger Things 2, that's on Netflix.
Yes, without spoiling anything, Helen, because I'm going to watch it tomorrow.
And have you seen all 145 episodes?
I've seen all 9 episodes of Stranger Things 2.
Surely they missed a trip by not having 11.
I mean, maybe, but let's not criticise a Netflix show for having too few episodes.
That's a fair point.
Since it is much to be desired, because peak TV is hard, you guys. It's really hard.
It really is. It's so stressful.
This is one of the few Netflix shows to get a second season, because, as you know, traditionally... they don't hand those things out like confetti, but Stranger Things did pretty well. As
Stranger
I understand
Things
it.
Did pretty well last time. It's one of the biggest shows of last year, and I liked this season better than the first one. I was a little bit uninvolved somehow in the first one, and I liked all the characters a bit more this time. Good news is Will has not been kidnapped and taken to the Upside Down again, but he is still haunted by his experiences there. So that's a thread of the episode of this season. It's no spoiler because you've seen the trailer to say that Eleven comes back, but I won't say in what way, how, when, who, with, or anything else about her, but she is there in it again. And I think what's great this time is they've kind of doubled down on the characters, because it is kind of a show about nothing. Like, it doesn't have a great thing to say to us as a society except, oh my god, the 80s were awesome. So I think it's a good thing to double down on the characters and actually make us care about them, and so we get good stuff for Dustin and Lucas and Mike to do this time, which is much to be desired. You've got a couple of love triangles going on in there. You've got some new characters, most notably Sean Astin as Bob, who is dating Winona Ryder's character Joyce this time around. So Mikey from the Goonies rides again, all good stuff. And also we should mention Max, who's played by Sadie Sink, who's the new girl in school, and she's a sort of subject of fascination for the boys because she plays video games better than any of them.
Wow.
Yeah.
And is the music as fabulous this time around?
Yeah. There are big, big 80s hits in here. If you go into it looking for the music, you will like it. And of course they also dress up as Ghostbusters for Halloween, which is fun.
What's not to love? I think this is everyone's weekend taken care of, is it not?
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Well, he's got to go see Thor again.
That's
I
true,
guess.
Yeah.
No, I'm off to Liverpool again to...
Snore.
To just depress myself.
Excellent.
Cool.
Moving on.
So, yeah.
Yeah, good. Yeah. Everyone watch Stranger Things. I know I will.
Yeah, we give it 4 stars.
I'd have to... Yeah. 4 stars.
4 stars, which is a recommendation.
It is a recommendation, and then some... I haven't seen the first season. Should I watch the first season?
You haven't seen the first season?
No.
Ah, Empire Magazine gave it 3 stars.
3 stars.
Yes, Johnny Pyle gave it 3 stars, and then we argued about it for about a month in the office.
You say that in a way that indicates that you're throwing Johnny under the bus now.
I am. I do it quite regularly. In fact, he apologised this morning by writing 4 stars on a Stranger Things napkin, which I tweeted. So I feel that deep down, he is contrite, and he has seen the error of his ways.
I'd agree with him for season 1.
Helen, get out of the podcast.
Anyway, on that note, that is it for this week's Empire Podcast. Thank you so much to Sam Bain for joining us earlier on. And do not forget to check out the retreat at the Park Theatre. And hey, say hello to Max of Max's Sandwich Shop. Mention the discount code Hewitt to get no money off your sandwiches. And do keep them peeled, of course. We have a couple of specials coming up over the next few weeks. We have a Red Dwarf special, which we really should record our half of.
We really do need to do that.
We will be doing that next week and getting it up while Series 12 is actually still on air. We're going to have a Thor Ragnarok special as well. Look out for that on November 6th. That's going to be us and also with director Taika Waititi. And you know what? I think we're going to have a Paddington 2 special as well.
Hurrah!
Yeah. No, it's not really a spoiler special type thing, but some films deserve to have the treatment.
Dude, spoil it for me now. What does he have on his sandwiches?
Marmalade.
Wow.
Marmalade.
That's the big plot point from the film.
Marmalade.
Ruined.
Marmalade Paddington. Paddington Marmalade. So there we go. It's a fantastic film. So keep your ears peeled for that one. Hopefully. Fingers crossed. And join us next week for more film-related fun when we will be calming down with the guest Jamboree. We've had a lot of guests recently, but next week we're going to be joined by Tobin Bell, who is, of course, as we've established, Jigsaw, John Kramer in the Jigsaw movies. Doesn't matter that he died in Saw 3. He's back for every single one. And we'll also be joined by someone else.
Who's that?
I don't know!
Okay!
But it's going to be fun finding out. Until that auspicious occasion, it is goodbye from James Dyer.
Goodbye.
It's goodbye from Helen O'Hara.
Toodaloo.
And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to Max's Sandwich Shop in Finsbury Park to sit down and try my very best to make Mike Wank happen.
That's never going to happen.
It's going to happen.
It's so unfetch.
Thanks. Oh, that's a good catchphrase. Thanks for listening. See you later. See you later. Bye.